Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, U.S.-led aggression from Gaza to Venezuela. Writer Justin Podor highlights why the U.S. and Israel use military violence against Venezuelans and Palestinians.
Part of what's driven the Americans and the Israelis to such brutal genocidal levels is the actual inability to get collaborators. Imperialism is primarily about collaborators, and firepower is what they use when they can't get the collaborators that they need.
On the Resistance Report, John Elmer tells us about messages of solidarity from the Palestinian resistance to the people of Venezuela.
When Venezuela was the victim of this attack, the resistance spoke up. Today's targeting of Venezuela is a punishment for its steadfast international positions, particularly its historic and unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and the resistance forces in our region, and its standing with our people against war crimes and genocide.
And the Electronic Intifada's executive director shares details about a legal victory.
They put me in prison to stop me speaking, and they were successful at stopping those events.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on January 8th, 2026. Later in the show, we speak with Justin Podor about U.S. aggression in Venezuela and Gaza. He's the host of the Anti-Empire Project and author of books such as Siege Breakers, a novel about resistance in Gaza, and with Joe Emmersberger, Extraordinary Threat, which critiques U.S. policy and details U.S.-backed coup attempts in Venezuela. On the Resistance Report, John Elmer brings us more details of martyred Palestinian fighters commemorated on posters and why the resistance speaks out against the U.S. attack on Venezuela. But first, on January 25th, 2025, the Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abunima, was abducted off the street by plainclothes officers in Zurich, Switzerland. He was on his way to speak at an event about the genocide in Gaza and the complicity of Swiss institutions in these ongoing crimes. He was thrown into a cell for 3 days without being allowed to contact his family or communicate with the outside world, and then forcibly deported. Ali launched an appeal and is here to give us an update about a legal victory with his case.
Yeah, thanks, Nora. I think this is not just my victory. It's a victory for all of us. And I would like to offer it and dedicate it to all of us, to all of our supporters and the people who supported me last January after I was arrested in Switzerland and, as you said, jailed for 3 days and then deported. And why? You know, let's keep a focus on the central reason why that happened. It's because I was going to speak at public events to educate people about the genocide in Gaza. That's why they did it. They put me in prison to stop me speaking. And they were successful at stopping those events. And now we have a court decision that was issued on December 19th. We appealed my detention. The administrative court of the Canton of Zurich ruled on 19 December that my arrest and detention last year was unlawful and violated the Swiss Constitution and the European Convention on Human Rights because there was never any lawful basis for my detention. And the ruling goes into more detail about how basically it every stage, the procedures that the police carried out against me were illegal, but not just illegal, but violated the European Convention on Human Rights. So this, I hope, has a wider relevance across Europe where there is so much of this repression. So I'm delighted about that.
So lay out what this ruling means, what the next step is. What about compensation for your human rights being violated and the fact that you were thrown into this detention facility for essentially being Palestinian and planning to talk about Palestine and Gaza?
Well, one thing I'll say is that the court awarded our legal costs. So that's great. The Canton of Zurich will have to pay the legal costs for this. They have 30 days to appeal. Of course, they could. It is a very strong decision. It is a sweeping decision. They said everything that happened basically was blatantly illegal, unconstitutional, and baseless. So I would be surprised if the Canton of Zurich were to appeal, but in theory they could. But after 30 days, it becomes final, and then I can apply for compensation for my false imprisonment. Now, from what I've understood, the compensation is relatively minimal, but to me, it's a matter of principle. And as I said in my statement, I will donate whatever compensation I get for the direct benefit of people in Gaza. And this struggle is really for them. That's why I think it's important to stand up to this, because this was an attack on our ability, all of us, our ability to speak out and to continue to advocate. I was invited to Switzerland by Swiss citizens and people living in Switzerland who wanted to exercise their right, their constitutional right of freedom of speech and association. And so they also were denied that right to talk about, to organize, to get together, talk about how we're going to hold our own government accountable for its complicity in this genocide. How are we going to educate our fellow citizens in Switzerland and organize them? This was to prevent that. And so that's why it's so important to fight back.
Yeah.
We have several other cases that I've filed, and those decisions could come out anytime. So let me just explain. This appeal was against the Canton of Zurich. So Switzerland is a federal system. So the cantons are like, you know, roughly like the US states. Mm-hmm. So this was an action against the Canton of Zurich, which actually imprisoned me. The police arrested me and they put me in a prison that belongs to the Zurich Canton. And so this was against them, and we won a clear victory. And it said that all of the actions by the Zurich Canton were illegal. The other actions we have two actions pending in the federal court in Switzerland. So that's the national court. And those actions are against FEDPOL, which is the federal police. And the federal police are the ones who, at the request of the Zurich Canton, issued an entry ban after I entered Switzerland, and then issued an expulsion order. And as we've exposed, and as our colleague Aisu Winstanley has written, based on the documents that have come out, FEDPOL, the federal police, knew there was no basis for issuing an entry ban or an expulsion order on the basis of which Zurich then arrested me. They knew that. They rejected the request initially. And then what was revealed is direct political interference. We know now, because in November, a Swiss parliamentary committee issued a report. They investigated, and what they said is that after FEDPOL turned down the request to issue an entry ban, Nicoletta Della Valle, who was the head of FEDPOL at the time, made a phone call to her subordinate and ordered them to issue an entry ban in violation of any procedures and without any new evidence or basis, and with no basis recorded in the files. There's no document that says these are the reasons we're overturning the initial rejection of the entry ban. This was a completely improper political procedure. And it's very notable, and even the Swiss press has covered this, that Nicoletta Della Valle is very pro-Israel. And she retired months after this incident where I was arrested and immediately was given a very lucrative position with an Israeli hedge fund that is very involved in the weapons industry. So
can't make this up.
You could, but this is why the legal action is so important to me, because we want to expose how this all happened. So we're waiting for the decisions from the Federal Administrative Court, where we are asking them to declare that the entry ban and the expulsion order were unlawful and to basically nullify them. And the other thing I'll say without going into more detail is that I have filed several criminal complaints in Switzerland related to this matter. And criminal complaints usually deal with individual wrongdoing. I'm not going to say more about that right now.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Congratulations to you and to all of us and to the activists in Zurich.
Who have been, you know, I've heard gotten so many messages from people everywhere, actually, but especially in Switzerland. And they're saying, when are you going to come back? When are you going to come to Zurich? And, you know, I will come back. I mean, let's hopefully win the remaining cases. And then I would very much like to come back and to complete the mission I went to Switzerland for, which was to listen to people there about how they're organizing and to offer whatever knowledge and analysis that I can. We were supposed to do that over 2 days. We were stopped from doing it. As soon as it's possible for me to go back and do that, I intend to do that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ali.
That was the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima. While people in Switzerland await Ali's return, rest assured that this program airs weekly on the airwaves in Zurich, thanks to our friends at Radio Laura. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Still to come on Electronic Intifada Radio.
Chavismo would be the target even if their oil was all turned into blue cheese overnight. They would still target Chavismo because of the ideology, the idea of people mobilizing to get things from the government, the idea of solidarity with Cuba and Haiti and Palestine. And that's the target above all.
We hear from Justin Podor of the Anti-Empire Project about the U.S. attack on Venezuela. But before we get to that, let's join the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer with this week's Resistance Report.
This is the Resistance Report for day 825 of Israel's genocidal war. It's also been 91 days since the ceasefire agreement was signed, and I'll give an update on the status of that ceasefire today, but I think everybody knows it's not much of a ceasefire. But let's begin with the messages of solidarity from the Palestinian resistance to the people of Venezuela. So after the designation of Venezuela as a foreign terrorist organization in late December and the formal ordering of a blockade on all sanctioned oil as a prelude to the kidnapping of President Maduro, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine responded that classifying the Venezuelan leadership as terrorist is blatant American thuggery, and the real terrorist is the one who burns nations and supports wars of annihilation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine condemns in the strongest terms the announcement by the U.S. President Donald Trump classifying Venezuelan leadership as a foreign terrorist organization, affirming that this decision presents the peak of political piracy and a blatant assault on the will of people and the usurpation of sovereignty. They went on to say, "It is the American leadership involved up to its ears in supporting wars of genocide, especially in Palestine, and responsible for destroying homelands and burning nations around the world that should be classified as terrorist and pursued internationally. We send a message of solidarity and pride to Venezuela, to its leadership and its people in confronting this escalation of American crime. And we call on all free people of the Latin American continent, as well as the entire world, to unite and confront American piracy that aims to eliminate anyone who dares say no in the face of imperial hegemony." The other Palestinian factions also were involved, and I think Islamic Jihad's statement really captured the sentiment of all of the factions when they said, "We condemn the vicious American aggression against the Republic of Venezuela and the attacks targeting its capital, Caracas, and its loyal people. These aggressive actions, which have escalated from naval blockade to direct military strikes, reveal intentions of hegemony, occupation, and forcible domination, and constitute a flagrant violation of international law and national sovereignty. They are also the extension of imperialist policies aimed at subjugating peoples and plundering their resources. Today's targeting of Venezuela is a punishment for its steadfast international positions, particularly its historic and unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and the resistance forces in our region, and its standing with our people against war crimes and genocide. The Venezuelan people's struggle for freedom and sovereignty is part of our nation's own battle against hegemony and neocolonialism. Hamas said along those same lines that it was an extension, the American actions, this American assault, was an extension of the unjust U.S. interventions driven by imperial ambition that have destabilized multiple countries across the world. The popular resistance committees condemned the attack as global fascism and savagery and demonstrated the ugly face of successive U.S. administrations. And Hezbollah, too, had a statement about Venezuela. They said that they strongly condemn the terrorist aggression and American thuggery against the Republic of Venezuela, calling it an unprecedented and blatant violation of national sovereignty of an independent state, international law, and the United Nations charters based on flimsy and false pretext. The attack constitutes a renewed affirmation of the approach of domination, arrogance, and piracy practiced by the American administration without any restraint, and stark proof of its disregard for international stability and security. It entrenches the law of the jungle and detonates what remains of the structures of the international order and hollows out of any substance that could serve as a guarantee or a safeguard of the people or the states of the world. The United States of America, which continues to live in a frenzy of control and hegemony, repeatedly exposes its true criminal face from Afghanistan to Iraq, Yemen, and Iran through the manufacturing of terrorism and support for its protege, Israel, which shares the same criminal, aggressive, and colonial behavior. And it's important to say about Hezbollah, the links between Hezbollah and Venezuela are very strong. I reported on the 2006 July war between Israel and Hezbollah, and there were pictures, posters, billboards, entire building-sized billboards up for Chavez at that time, who spoke forcefully against the Israeli invasion. This position on Israel is built into the Bolivarian Revolution and into Venezuelan state policy. Chavez called the 2006 July war a fascist outrage and said that the Israelis should stand trial for that. So those kind of strong statements of solidarity have a long history in the region. And so when Venezuela was the victim of this attack in these past few weeks, the resistance spoke up about that. The raid on Venezuela involved 150 U.S. aircraft from 20 bases, months of planning, and was part of a spate of U.S. attacks this year, which included participating fully in the genocide in Gaza, providing weapons and ammunition to the tune of $25 billion for Israel to carry out that genocide, along with its war against Yemen, which really lasted the entire time, the entire 2 years of the war, but was, of course, highlighted by the, or lowlighted by the 50-day war that Trump waged against Yemen, failing war against Yemen, the 12-day war against Iran, and strikes in Syria, Iraq, Somalia, and Nigeria. So strong statements of support for the Venezuelan people from the resistance in Gaza and Hezbollah as well. The PFLP also noted the martyrs that we talked about on last week's show. PFLP Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades put out this martyr poster for the chief of staff of the Qassam Brigades, Mohammed Sinwar. Mohammed Sinwar was assassinated on the 13th of May, but they just, Qassam Brigades just officially announced it a little over a week and a half ago. The PFLP announced their martyrs from the Battle of Al-Aqsa Flood. They said that our martyrs are the beacon of liberation and return. They are the eagles of the glorious October 7th epic. And these are fighters from the West Bank, Gaza, and Lebanon. In Lebanon, a number of senior leaders were assassinated, most notably Mohammed Halil Wishash, who was the commander and central committee member who was assassinated in Lebanon on the Lebanon-Syria road with a couple of his comrades in August of 2025. The PFLP said their blood will become a testament to the great truth that martyrdom is a deeper presence in the collective consciousness of our people and our nation, and that the martyr has become an idea that never fades, a legacy that flows through the veins of the resistance, becoming a seed that sprouts a thousand fighters and a resounding voice that awakens an entire nation. The PFLP did acknowledge their fallen fighters during the war, something that Qassam did not do. Islamic Jihad did not do either, but this is the first comprehensive accounting for the PFLP of their fighters lost. And of course, their fighters, they lost many fighters in Lebanon during the Lebanon front of this war. The Qassam Brigade's martyr poster for their top leaders that says, "We will continue the path and we will not stop the march." And it's important to note that these are all of the significant leaders, Mohammed Daif in the center there, but all of their top founding leaders that were killed in this war. But it hasn't destroyed the group, neither the resistance group, but also after the war, Hamas has internal elections prepared for later this month. They intend to hold those elections for leadership positions in Gaza, the West Bank, and abroad for the Shura Council and the Politburo. The political bureau and the movement confirms that Gaza is fully prepared to participate in the electoral process. Communication among the leadership remains intact despite Israeli aggression aimed at it for 2 years. All vacancies resulting from the assassination of commanders have been filled and were filled immediately, something that we've known from the past 2 years of experience. But just to put a fine point on that, that the assassinations, for example, of Mohammed Sinwar happened months before the ceasefire. So the battle continued without any appreciable difference in command. The same with Mohammed Daif, who was killed the summer before in July of 2024. There was no way to see that these crucially important leaders were no longer at the helm, and that the resistance group and its military formation was able to immediately replace those who were killed. And that is the militant structure, the army-like structure that the Qassam Brigades set up. And it was something that allowed them to foil all of Israel's attempts to destroy and to claim victory in the genocide in Gaza. And just a note that Netanyahu talked about the strength of Qassam despite the loss of these leaders when he went to the U.S. at the end of December, and he went to meet with Trump in Mar-a-Lago. And he talked about the fact that there's 60,000 rifles held in the hands of Qassam fighters in Gaza. He said that there's 20,000 fighters still remain with 60,000 weapons, meaning that disarming them is to take the weapons away from them. They still have hundreds of kilometers of terror tunnels, as he describes them, terrors for Israeli forces for sure, and Hamas refuses to disarm. So Trump, when he was speaking with Netanyahu at Mar-a-Lago, said, "If they do not disarm, it will be terrible for them. It is going to be really bad. They signed an agreement and Israel cannot be blamed. There are other countries ready to enter and eliminate them," which we know is not true. And if it is true, it's not going to happen. Israel couldn't do it in 2 years with $25 billion of U.S. support. And it's unclear how a smaller force would be able to do that. But they're still living that fantasy. So it's clearly not a ceasefire. But since the ceasefire went into effect, more than 420 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed. 145 of them are children. 1,200 have been wounded in upwards of 1,000 military violations, 300 of which were direct fire at civilians, 54 armored vehicle incursions beyond the yellow line, 455 strikes on homes, airstrikes and artillery, tank fire. And this is all in addition to the demolition that's happening of homes and, frankly, entire neighborhoods on the eastern side of the yellow line. The government media office in Gaza said that only 42% of aid trucks that had been agreed upon have entered, And even more critically, only 10% of the fuel that was agreed upon has entered. And of course, that fuel is what is necessary for indigenous rebuilding in Gaza, which has already begun, but is seriously curtailed by a lack of fuel. The crossings still remain closed. The siege still remains on, aimed now at NGOs that work in Gaza, and the tents and mobile homes that were agreed upon have still not arrived, despite the catastrophic winter conditions that we have seen in Gaza, and people are still in deteriorating tents. So Israel not holding up their end of the ceasefire, of course, as we all knew would be the case. On January 1st, summary a report by the IDF on the year that had passed, they boasted about 20,900 airstrikes. 19,530 of those were in Gaza, the remainder in Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Yemen, and the West Bank. So this is something they want people to know. 91 soldiers were killed in 2025. 821 were seriously wounded, 81 by the resistance in Gaza, and 6 by fighters in the West Bank. Also, just to note, the IDF boasted about arresting 7,400 Palestinians in the West Bank in the year 2025, and also bragged, as they do, about stealing money from people in the West Bank. They bragged about stealing 16,480,000 shekels from Palestinian homes, $5 million US stolen from private homes in Gaza and from money exchanges in the West Bank. So that is the resistance report for day 825 of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up next, Ali Abunima joins me to discuss U.S. and Israeli aggression against Venezuela and Gaza with writer, podcaster, and academic Justin Podor.
President Donald Trump told the New York Times on Wednesday that he expected the United States would be running Venezuela and extracting its oil for years to come. This comes after the U.S. attack on Venezuela on January 3rd, which killed dozens of people, and the brazen kidnapping of its president, Nicolas Maduro, and First Lady, Celia Flores. These acts appear to establish a new benchmark in flagrant American imperial lawlessness, aggression, and contempt for the sovereignty of other countries. The Trump administration is notorious for its lying, but senior White House advisor Stephen Miller was undoubtedly telling the truth when he told CNN on Sunday that, quote, "We live in a world in which you can talk all you want about international niceties and everything else, but we live in a world, in the real world, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power." The United States is now openly threatening Colombia and Cuba, and America's European vassals are seriously worried that Trump might order an invasion of Greenland, an autonomous territory governed by NATO member Denmark. Recently, Trump also declared that if Iran, quote, "violently kills peaceful protesters, which is their custom, the United States will come to their rescue." Trump added, "We are locked and loaded and ready to go." Meanwhile, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been setting out the plans for the United States to control Venezuela, doing so in a way that does away with the usual pretenses about bringing democracy and human rights. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told reporters that the decisions of Venezuela's leaders are, quote, "going to be dictated by the United States." Meanwhile, as Israel's genocide continues in Gaza, albeit at a slightly slower pace and largely out of the headlines, there is also a growing concern that the United States and Israel may be preparing to launch another round of aggression against Iran following their attack last June and the so-called 12-day war. Our guest today to talk about these issues is Justin Podor. Justin is the author of Siege Breakers, a 2019 novel in which Palestinians in Gaza win a war of liberation, and he is the co-author with Joe Emmisberger of the book Extraordinary Threat, The U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. He runs the Anti-Empire Project podcast and YouTube channel, including the Gaza Sitrep series. Those familiar with Justin's work know that he has provided invaluable insight and analysis throughout Israel's genocide and the resistance to U.S. Israeli aggression in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, and he has kept a close eye on Venezuela. Justin, welcome back. Let's get into it. Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, now the country's acting leader, stated that the U.S. attack on her country and the abduction of President Maduro had, quote, Zionist undertones. What do you think she meant by that? And what do you understand by that?
Well, I, you know, there are definitely Zionist